Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
The celebration is on. It's still theirs until someone rips it out of their hands.
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour Podcast. Rosie, we are out of the All-Star break alongside a man who has put a ring on it in Chris Rosenthal. We'll get to that later. And a very special guest in a man who was just inducted to the PLL Hall of Fame, Joe Walters, joining the show. Joe, welcome and thanks for hopping on.
Hell yeah, thanks for having me.
Joe, I've said this a few times to coworkers, fellow media members covering the sport, that you are a very special player to me, and that, you know, I was watching lacrosse growing up to your Maryland games and watching your 2006 team and your kind of illustrious career there just really got me into the sport. So one, a little nervous, as you can tell, just popped a Bud Light. I telling other media members, they're like, oh, what are like some of the interviews you get like nervous at? You ever like talk to Paul Rabel or John Grant Jr.? I'm like, ah, those guys are a breeze. I talked to Joe Walters once his final season with the Redwoods, and I was a little nervous. So no, I appreciate you coming on, Joe. It was fun to see you getting inducted into the Pro Lacrosse Hall of Fame, and just tell us how the whole weekend went for you.
Yeah, well, first off, thank you. I appreciate it. you know, nowadays, not too many kids coming up know who I am, so it just means you're getting old, dude. It means you're getting old with me.
Yeah, exactly.
It was cool, man. It was special. You know, I got to be on the West Coast. My parents are still in Rochester, New York, so it was especially cool to have them there with me. They came with my fiance, Adrian. We all met in Chicago, and you know, the entire weekend was just completely first class, you know, which you'd expect nothing less from the PLL. Whirlpool, who's one of the, you know, league sponsors, not sponsors, but they do a lot of advertising with the league now.
Partners, right?
So partners, yeah. And we had at the, I don't know if it's their headquarters, but they have this building in Chicago, and I had no idea what it was, like World of Whirlpool. That was like the building name, or like that's what was on the itinerary. And I was like, oh, cool. It's probably some like bar, or like restaurant. I was sick. It was going to be awesome. And I show up and it's like their headquarters, and you go up to the rooftop. It was just absolutely incredible. Like right in the center, the river's running through it. So it was just, it was a great weekend. And obviously to be inducted is super special. Being, you know, alongside Paul, Kevin Lavelle and Kyle Harrison, you know, also it's just, truly, it's an honor. So it was a great weekend.
Loaded class. Did you make it on the boat?
I didn't make it on the boat. So that was on Thursday. We flew in on Friday. So Thursday was the boat and street lacrosse. Didn't make it in. We had some stuff going on here. But next time. It looked pretty sweet.
Now, just talking about the class itself, what was it like for you when you get that phone call, or however they presented it to you, that, you know, you're going in the hall? What was that, you know, initial reaction like for you?
It was surreal. You know, I just, I definitely didn't expect it. Just being, you know, so freshly removed from playing. But it was awesome. You know, I got the call from Rachel from the league. I did a little Zoom and, you know, again, just surprised, shocked. But they took a while for it to set in, and you kind of do a little, you kind of pause and you think about the guys that you're going in with, guys that I've you know, grown up with, you know, guys that I've been through a lot with professionally, and just been teammates with some of these guys, but played against them for many years. And, you know, you kind of develop as players, as pros. And it was just, it was a great time to reflect on that.
You know, you first ballot Hall of Famer, like you mentioned, you're now what, fourth all time in points now that Rob has surpassed you. Now third all time in assist, right? Just you're up here in all these categories. You played with Paul with the Lizards and kind of joining with the joining his league with the PLL in 2019, and you know, just you, Paul, Kyle Harrison, just all retire kind of around the same time, and to be joining in this same class really speaks to one, how loaded that kind of crazy off season was, but two, just the longevity of your careers. What were some of the keys for you individually to maintain your level of consistency throughout your 11-year all-star, 11 all-star games, right? And
yeah, I think it was six. I played 16 years. So
16 years, yeah, crazy.
It's crazy. You know, I that is probably the one thing that I want to say I'm most proud of, but I'm really proud of just the longevity aspect. You know, it's not easy, especially I think in lacrosse where, you know, guys start to have families, guys start to have different priorities. And it makes it hard to be a lacrosse player, a professional lacrosse player. I, as well as, you know, Kevin, Paul, and Kyle, we've made lacrosse our career. You know, we're doing a lot in lacrosse. And I think that's probably the biggest factor in being able to play that long. You know, obviously the staying in shape, the working out, the being sharp, that's a huge piece, just as big. But I think being in the sport really helped me. You know, if I was, I talked about it when I was for my speech, but my mom, she owns multiple properties and she owns a restaurant. I was like potentially going to go in that route with her. But I'm really lucky that my parents both pushed me to just follow my dream and just stay in the sport, you know, make it a full-time profession. And that really helped.
You know, speaking of which, just, you know, the family background when you were younger, we heard from Tim Sudan after his game. And, you know, they're asking if he had any sort of memories of you. And he mentioned knowing about you from a long, long time ago, right? Like a kid who was always hanging out at practices. And he said, you're always there. And if you weren't there, they'd be surprised. They'd be like, you know, hey, where's the kid? You know, he thought he'd be around here. Where is he? What was that experience like for you? How did you end up, you know, kind of always being around those guys? And was the hunger to, you know, learn and soak things up something you just always had?
That's really cool he said that. He's not wrong. You know, I growing up, I can remember going to Rochester Nighthawks practices. They were at like Salmon Creek. They're at these like different practice facilities in Rochester. And how lucky am I to like go there and watch Tim Sudan and John Grant Jr. and Paul Gate at the time, like some of the game's greatest players, just watch them practice. And I can remember like between like, you know, they got a timeout or they're getting water and I'll go out and like shoot on the net as a little guy. So yeah, I mean, he's not wrong. Like I was always around, and I think that's just falling in love with the sport. You know, I started playing when I was 8, and my dad, I talked about my dad being one of my biggest lacrosse heroes. He never played lacrosse, but he learned the sport with me. Took me anywhere, like took me everywhere, any camps that were in the area. I went to like Princeton camp growing up. I went to camps all over, and he would go and like take notes and like go to the camp with me and learn. And then we'd go back home and we'd work on the stuff that we learned at camp. So, if I didn't have that, you know, I don't know what kind of career, what kind of player I would have been growing up, but he's such a huge part of my success is just having that that guidance and that you know, him pushing me and bringing me around to all these places. It just helped me fall in love with the game.
That, yeah, amount of support is definitely beneficial. I would also say the amount of obsession and discipline you must have had in those early years really kind of manifested in the career you did have, because like just the play style that you employed, right? Like silky mitts, just one of the probably the smoothest player I've ever watched. Just you always kind of had an answer for what the defense was giving you. They knew you wanted to go left, but you can get there in a variety of ways. Just how did you stay in those early years? Like, and you know, Phil Shore wrote a great feature on you in the lead up to the induction. Just you looking up to Casey Powell and John Grant Jr. growing up with around those Nighthawks practices. Just one, a couple cool things based off of that. Just the one, the title with the Nationals. What, your second year, third year in the MLL, and then you're in that kind of the centerpiece in that trade with Casey Powell and with the Florida launch when they get started, and now you're headed to play back for Dave Cottle as you're going back to your Maryland days. So just describe some of those cool like bookend experiences of your playing career, and maybe some lessons kind of learned along the way a little bit.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I talk about it a lot with kids. You know, there's two aspects there. Like, number one, it's so important as a player, you know, you have to practice on your own. It's not about, you know, your team practice. It kind of drives me crazy because, you know, kids now are playing on a ton of different teams, and whatever practices they have, that's great. Like, you know, if whoever has a three practices a week, that's fine, but understand that at those practices, you're going to be working on and learning your team stuff, like your team plays and your team, you know, rides and clears or whatever it might be. You're not going to get a lot of stick work in. You're not going to get a lot of shooting or dodging reps at your team's practice. So that's got to be on your own, right? And you can't just, oh, I had, you know, two practices this week, stuff's in my bag, I'll be at the tournament this weekend. That's just not it. So I was, you use the word, I was obsessed growing up with not only the practice part, you know, and it wasn't teams practice, just on my own. Like, I would go in the backyard, I would go to a field with my dad, I would hit the wall, I would shoot like hours, you know, every day. And that's just what it takes, you know, it's any sport, you know, Kobe, Mike, you know, Michael Jordan, Steph Curry, you're not going to be great at your sport unless you are obsessed and you work on your own. It doesn't matter what you're doing. But the other aspect is like, just as important as this to practice and play, I think it's so important to watch lacrosse. So growing up, I had the luxury, you know, didn't have the luxury of having all these games on TV that kids do now. So like, there's no excuse to not watch a ton of lacrosse. But I was at every Syracuse game growing up. And when I first started, Casey Powell was like, he was like God to me. He was like the man. I had a Casey Powell poster in my room, and I just idolized him because of how he played. You know, he was the best player in the nation. Even before that, like Roy Colsey was probably the first guy that I saw play in the dome, and I was like, wow, this dude is a beast. Then it was Casey, and then Ryan, and then I got to like play against Mike Powell like for a few years in high school. We scrimmaged their team, and I was like, man, these guys, like even like he's 2 years older than me, I was like, damn, this guy is like unreal. And, you know, I'm sure high school kids, I coach high school kids now, and they, you know, they always talk about different kids that are a year or two above them, and they, you know, it's what's so cool, you know, you watch and you want to emulate those guys. But yeah, like the Casey thing is super special, and John Grant super special, because I grew up watching them. And then to be able to play alongside them, you know, I think that's, when I think about it, I thought about it today because Casey texted me, and, you know, he made the comment that like watching me grow up, and, you know, because I've known him since I was literally like in sixth, seventh grade, again, going to those practices and stuff. And you know,
him coming to your mom's restaurant, right?
Yeah, my mom's restaurant. Like, he used to come there. He gave me, like, sticks. Like, he was with Warrior back in the day, so he would give me all this new stuff. And, like, I felt like I was the coolest kid in the world. But, like, to be able to suit up alongside him was just something that, you know, you really, really can't describe that. You know, it's like your hero, and then you get to play alongside him. You get to win a championship together. Same with John Grant. It's like the same exact thing. It's special. It's really special.
And you mentioned watching guys like Casey, you know, when you're growing up, kind of, you know, learning from them. But your style of play is pretty signature. It looks pretty unique compared to a lot of other guys. Who would you say you were, like, trying to emulate? Were you trying to copy Casey's style and it just kind of morphed into your own unique style? Because yours is pretty signature.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really know. It's tough because my game's, like, it's changed and evolved so much since I was in high school. Like, when I was growing up, I played midfield, and I still think, like, to this day, like, kids that are playing, like, the best players should play midfield because you get to play defense, you clear the ball, you're on offense, you're, like, you are a huge part of what's going on in the game. When I got to high school, I started playing attack because coaches wanted me to stay on the field the whole time, right? And when I went to, so again, same thing, like when I was a freshman in high school, I was a finisher. Sophomore, I handled the ball more. And then same thing, junior, senior year. Then when I got to Maryland, my freshman year, I was a finisher again. Didn't really handle the ball, like, you know, a little bit to transfer it, but, like, we had ball carriers. My job was mainly just put the ball in the net, get open, put the ball in the net. And then my next year, sophomore year, that's when I took on more responsibility. And then the same thing, junior, senior year. And it's almost like when I got drafted to the MLL, I was playing attack, right? So that's 8 years of attack, high school in Maryland. And then when I got drafted to the MLL, John Grant Jr. is the lefty attack man. Well, I'm not going to, like, beat him out. So I started playing midfield, and it was great because I was getting a shorty. Back then, there was only three poles on the field at a time. So I was getting a shorty every possession, and, like, that's incredible. So I'm gonna cook. I'm going to go to work.
Yeah.
But still, it's like, you know, the first couple of years, I'm diverting to, you know, junior and some of these guys that are older, they're veterans, and they've been around, and they've played, and they attract a lot of attention. I'll kind of feed off of that a little bit. And I want to say that my game really changed and really developed when I started playing box. That's the biggest, if I can, like, pinpoint one thing, it's when I started playing box, specifically when I played senior A in Canada. Like, that's when my game really evolved and became kind of what it was. Just the tight quarters, the, you know, handling pressure, the two-man game, finishing. You know, I was always able to get to my strong hand, but, like, in box, you're literally taught to just go to your strong hand. So it suited my game, but it also made me, like, the player that I ultimately became.
Shout out Brampton. Shout out the Rochester Nighthawks three-peat with Joe Walters. Hopefully they can find a new owner. If you're making enough money over there on JW1 Lacrosse on the West Coast, you can start making some investments up in your hometown.
I'm not, but I do wish that, you know, the franchise, well, I hope that someone steps up. Is that in limbo right now?
It is. I really don't have further details.
Yeah, it's a bummer. You know, it's a bummer. You know, I think that it's a challenge, right? In both leagues, like, you know, you're trying to get butts in the seats. In Rochester, it's, I don't know what's been going on, but it's definitely a challenge. You know, I think the biggest thing is trying to turn on new lacrosse fans, you know, not just the kids that play, but ultimately, like, this isn't new in Rochester. It's not new. Like, the team has come, it's gone. If you're a lacrosse player, if you're a lacrosse, you know, family, you gotta get to the games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was no excuse when I was growing up. I don't care what's on TV. I don't care, like, if we had a game, you know, earlier in the day, get to the game. Like that's you just got to support the franchise. You got to support the players, support, you know, the sport. That's the only way it's going to stay. So can't get upset if the team, you know, is not in a good spot if we're not supporting the team. So
No,
it's a
absolutely.
bummer.
You had a good on your homepage, the Lacrosse Network did a good feature on you back in 2015, kind of going through Rochester, and a line stuck out with, you know, you're the only one living in Rochester, and all these Canadians are playing alongside you and kind of going back home after the game. And it's the same deal a decade later in this arms race to get players and markets and extend seasons and get players full-time wages, kind of continues on. So from your vantage point, just to see this continue to take place, just what do you kind of foresee for, you know, the future and pro lacrosse in general from your vantage point?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, I used to work with the Nighthawks too. I was working in the front office, myself, Joel White, and Stephen Keough. We had positions with the team. We were sales. We were selling tickets and you know, doing stuff, you know, in schools in the community. And I really enjoyed that. And it's again, it's the same thing. It's like if you just have to get people in the stands. You know, and people that are lacrosse fans, you have to support the team. There's just no excuse. It is challenging. You know, it's challenging, especially in a market like Rochester. It can be expensive. You know, it can be expensive to go to a game. You know, we all know if you go to, you know, a basketball game or a baseball game, it's not cheap. You know, you got to buy a ticket and you get in, the concessions are expensive. So for a family, you know, of multiple kids that go to a game, that's it might not be like a every game thing. That's a treat. So I understand all aspects of it. But at the same time, like if you're a fan and you really love the team and you want the team to stay, then it's kind of our job. Like we gotta support. But yeah, it's just tough. It's tough seeing. You know, you watch games on TV and seeing, you know, empty seats. It's tough because it's a bummer because the sport's such a great one. You know, it's given me everything. I've loved it since I was 8 years old, and you know, you just want more people to experience it. And I think with the Olympics coming up, we're kind of going all over the place, but with the Olympics coming up, it's going to be great for the sport. More eyes are going to be on it, and maybe that will help catapult new fans to you know, search out the teams in the area and just check out the games.
You mentioned working the business side, you know, coaching, trying to get people in the stands, and obviously you played for quite a while as well. Do you have any interest, or have you thought about leaning into coaching, on a pro level or something like that?
Yeah, I wouldn't be opposed to it. I wouldn't be opposed to it. It's the only challenge is I love having the time off. I love having the weekends free. So that's the only thing, you know. It's tough as it is with the club teams that we have.
After
And
16
getting
years, that'll do it too.
it's nice to like to not travel every weekend. So that would be the one hurdle, the one obstacle. But you know, I'm lucky in that I get to spend, you know, my professional career now outside of playing in the lacrosse world, coaching and training and helping kids, you know, reach their goals like guys did for me growing up.
It is cool to see the SoCal pipeline will be strong and here before you know it. It really is here already. So no man, like the we've been gassing you up. You know, I looked up to you as a kid. Who are some guys that you see a little bit of yourself in? There's definitely a candidate on the Rochester Nighthawks, who kind of has some flair to his game, maybe a little more than you did. But who are some players today that you see some of your style in?
You know, I got asked that question kind of this weekend. Kieran McArdle is a guy that I think is really underrated. And, you know, he just gets it done. You know, I think that's something if, you know, I'm not scoring like highlight real goals, but I was consistent over those 16 years. And I think that he's the same way. You know, he just got, you know, reached the 500 club. And again, he's just a guy that, every game you'll see a stat line. It's like 2-2, 3-3, you know, 2-4. It's like, wow, he just puts up numbers. But he's a lefty, you can feed. I saw him throw like a nice no look pass, this past weekend. Like,
yeah, that was his 500th. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love his game. You know, he played box for a bit. I see a lot of my game in his. Yep, for sure.
So you said, you know, not so much a highlight kind of guy, but I do want to ask you about one particular highlight and take you back probably about 14 years now or so. You're playing with the Nationals, and you take this shot that literally rips a hole in the net. Do you recall that happening? And if so, what's the feeling when you rip a hole in the net with your shot?
Ooh, I don't know it. I don't know that. I would love to see it. I would love to
Rosie,
see it.
Pull it up. We need more of a technical setup
here.
Yeah,
it's on YouTube. We'll attach it to this when it goes up.
Please do. Please send it to me so I can show all the kids that I train that I had it back in the day. I don't know that shot, but I'd love to see it. I do remember a shot in high school where I did it. It was pretty cool. I have the footage. It's VHS, so it's like it's hella grainy, but at the same time, I remember it was a man up play, ball gets swung through X, I'm stepping down left-handed, and I shoot, and it pops. There's like a white tag on the backside of the net, and it pops the tag, so it was right in the corner too. One of my favorite goals from high school, which is, that's crazy how long ago that was. I mean, yeah, it's pretty cool.
How do you deal with that? With, like, as a high school, you got to feel like the baddest man on the planet when you're doing that in high school, right?
I remember that game. It was against. So I transferred from not transferred, but I lived in a town called Penfield, and I ended up moving to Irondequoit, which is where I went to high school. I went to middle school, then high school, and that game where I did it was against Penfield. And I believe it was in sectionals.
Oh, some extra meaning.
Yeah, extra meaning. I did go off that game. I think it was like 5-3. So like those kind of games fire you up a little bit more. And for that to happen in that game was pretty cool.
Now I want to ask you two things about, two questions about some, lines in your Maryland bio and then your PLL bio real quick. And, see your answers on both. You know, growing up in upstate, this illustrious Irondequoit career in high school, I wish Maryland still did this, but under personal, it says also recruited by Towson, Duke, Georgetown, Loyola, and Johns Hopkins. You know, it's September 1st is coming around the corner. Tell us a little bit about your recruiting story and maybe what was kind of the lure of leaving home a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, I was like, I got calls just like everyone does. And I forget the date. I don't know if it was September 1st back then. I don't remember what the day was.
No, it was probably way before. They were probably calling me in eighth grade.
Yeah, no. So that was after me.
Okay.
All that craziness happened like either when I was in college or after, right away after college. That's when kids started committing when they're in eighth grade, which is wild. But yeah. When I was in high school, I remember like you went through your recruiting summer, and I forget the day where the coaches can call you, but then you went on your 5 official visits, and that was in your senior year. So I remember my senior fall is when I went to, I forget all the schools that I think I went to Penn State. I was in Loyola, and I'll circle back on Georgetown and Hopkins and Duke, but you went on your 5 official visits where the school pays for it. And you get to spend a weekend with, you know, a player on the team. You go usually watch a football game or basketball game. Go on your 5 visits, then you commit. And I don't even know if it was a verbal commitment. I have no idea. I think it was just you sign your letter of intent, and that was it. I'm sure there probably was some sort of verbal commitment on the phone with the school, but that was, and I think, I don't know if kids even take officials. I'm pretty sure that they take officials after they've committed to that school. Like, that's when they take their official visit to the school. I'm pretty sure that now kids just like take these unofficial visits, and they go to a prospect day, and like that's
Yeah,
kind of like
prospect
their
days.
trip there. Which I think that's as a player, as a kid going through it now, I advise that, kids should spend time on that campus with a kid on the team, learning more about the culture, because it's a very important 4 years of your life to not do that. But for me, that was the recruiting process, and I was committed verbally to Loyola. Coach Cottle, I absolutely like loved him, trusted him, parents loved him, and I was committed on Loyola. I was like sold on Loyola. And Dick Adele stepped down. Coach Cottle got the Maryland job, called me the next day, offered me the same scholarship, and I was like in love with Maryland, and I was in a heartbeat said yes, because growing up I went to every Final Four, and for a number of years they were in College Park, so those were some of my first memories of like the Final Four in general is like one of the pinnacles of lacrosse, and being on campus, thousands, tens of thousands of people being in that that spotlight, it was just so appealing, and being at Maryland, so it was a dream school. And then also a guy, one of my assistant coaches in high school was Jay Whipple. His son is Andrew Whipple, played at Maryland, like wore number one, one of my like heroes growing up. So it was just all these things. As soon as he called me, got the Maryland job, I'm there in a heartbeat. So that's how I ended up at Maryland. But I got calls from Duke, Hopkins, Georgetown, and I did not have the grades, and it's something that I've just never been a great student, for whatever reason. I have a tough time, like I have a tough time with being a student. It didn't even, when I went to Maryland, I struggled as well. My freshman fall was one for the ages. I was very, very close, and I'm very lucky and grateful and fortunate that our athletic department, our the support team, gave me a chance to right my wrongs, and I had to take winter term classes and meet all these requirements to be able to stay in school. But I very well could have ended up back home at MCC or Herkimer, and I don't know what would have happened with my career. So very fortunate for that, but school's always been tough for me. And ultimately, when I told those schools, when they called me and I told them my grades, I told them my SATs, my PSATs, whatever it was that I had already taken, it was a pretty simple, sorry, this was not going to cut it. So that was it. And I can remember going to a Duke prospect day with a kid. I brought a kid there with his family. And Coach Danowski was asked, there was a like 200 kids there. He did like a Q&A with all the parents that were there. This is probably like 2000, I don't know, 2012, 2013, 14, somewhere in that range. And this is back then when lacrosse is, booming and growing, and it still is. But, a parent asked Coach Stanowski, like, how important are grades? We've heard that, even if you're a really, really good player and, you're a player that the school wants, that they can get you in. And he was like, listen, lacrosse is the fastest growing sport in the country. For every kid that, doesn't have the grades, there are 100 other players that do that are just as good somewhere in the country. So like it's a simple, you don't have the grades, keep it moving. So I really try, even though myself, I didn't do a great job growing up, I regret that, because it would have kept more doors open. So it's just so important for kids growing up these days and going through it, that you have to get good grades. You have to spend the time on your schoolwork. You have to make that commitment. to being the best student you can possibly be. It's tougher for some kids, you know, it's hard. I get it. So if you can't, it's I'm not like if there's things that don't allow you to be a good student, if you struggle, that's one thing. But like being lazy and being, you know, being a procrastinator like I was with my schoolwork is just not, it's not the look these days. You know, you want to keep as many doors open as you possibly can with how competitive the sport is.
Then part two, more of a softball here on your PLL bio page. Your nickname is J-Dub.
Yeah.
How often are you referred to as J-Dub, and where did that originate?
Often, you know, just my initials JW, so it's just got short to J-Dub. And then a lot of people, my roommates in college call me Dub, just DUB. So J-Dub, J-Dubs, Dub. It's just, yeah, something that, you know, people have been saying for years. But it originated from when I was growing up. Some coaches called me that, J-Dub, when I was like in middle school, high school.
Because all you get is dubs.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
It's funny. You wouldn't think somebody whose name is Joe would have that many nicknames. You know, you probably just think, you know, you go by Joe. It's not like it's that long or anything like that, but, you know.
Exactly.
The style works, though. It's a good stylistic nickname for you, though. You know, so Kevin just mentioned the PLL, so I want to hop in on that. PLL puts out a video years ago at this point highlighting, they had you mic'd up and highlighting some trash talk you were doing on the field. Was that unusual, or was that pretty common to do a little talking? And if so, who in the league joined in as well? Like, were there some talking rivalries you had, or anybody bring some good trash to the table?
Yeah, there's lots of great trash talkers. And I think that the PLL just does a good job of like promoting it and being hands-on with it. I mean, everyone's talking shit, you know, for the last multiple decades. That's a part of the game. It's for, you know, all sports, I think. But yeah, when I see those videos, I don't really watch them anymore because, you know, it makes me a little uncomfortable. But, you know, for me as a player, it just got me into the game. You know, it's not that. And I think it's important that kids kind of realize and understand that when it's between the 0 to 60 minutes or whatever the time of the game, 0 to 48, you know, you are playing a game. The helmet's on. For me, I was like a different person. You know, I'm a pretty laid back and reserved person, but when I have a helmet on, I'm like one of the loudest people on the field, one of the most vocal. And that's kind of how you have to be as a player. You have to be loud. Like, you know, communication in lacrosse is just so important. Any sport, but lacrosse specifically, you just have to communicate. So getting into the game, there's a couple things. Like, for me, I like to try to, like, get into a scoring play early on, whether it's an assist, a goal, dodging and moving it for like a hockey assist. Like getting involved in the offense for me early on was critical for me. It just kind of got me engaged. It helped me get a little confidence like right away. It just got me some juice from the first whistle. So, and there's been games where I kind of like either don't touch the ball or am not really involved. And it's not that I'm not doing anything, but like, it's just, there's a different level of intensity when you're like involved right away. So that's number one. But number two, like just manifesting some energy through, you know, the different, you know, parts of the game where you're, you know, a guy, you know, you're either someone that you don't like while we're playing or makes a bad play or does something dirty. And it's like, I'm going to give that back to you. Like, we're going to go back and forth. That gets me involved in the game too. It gets me fired up.
Did this prolific trash talking start in the Penfield game?
I don't remember. No, I don't think I was. I remember when we played Penfield. Every time their student section would always, you know, chant like traitor and all that stuff. So it would get me going. I don't remember if I would talk to the guys on the team, because a lot of those guys were like my friends. We played together. So I don't really think it was that so much, but just the jawing back and forth. I do remember actually in that game, scoring a goal, and I was getting chirped by the student section. And I looked back and I like shrugged my shoulders. So I do remember that actually.
That's wrong.
But it was never like it was never with the guys on the team because you know I have no disrespect to them.
Yeah, the smaller town, knowledgeable chance will always hit different.
Yeah.
What about like any kind of opponents that were stuck out in this kind of realm?
Yeah, I mean, I think the ones that in the video are like Mark McNeil, Scott Radcliffe. It's like those guys are just good because they would give it back, you know. So like it naturally it's easy to make that video, and the guys are jawing back and forth. But yeah, I mean, those guys just stick out. I have a hard time remembering like other guys that would chirp back and forth, but. You know, it's part of the game. You know, it really is. It's just part of the game. And I think after the game, you kind of put all that to the side. You know, it's different. It's different when the helmets come off. You know, you guys are your friends, your boys. And if there's things that are said that are too much, then we're not boys. it's all part of the game.
Now your lack of remembering the trash talk either says not safe for this podcast or it was indeed you know once you're in between those white lines it's a war, right? And once you leave it, it's hey, what even happened out there? you remember the plays, but you don't remember all the good stuff. So
My only thing about trash talking is you have to be in a position to back it up. You know what I mean? Like it's tough if you're someone that no one really knows and you're talking trash. It's like, well, who are you? Like, you know, and that's a great chirp back. Like, what's your name? Like, never heard of you, blah, blah, blah. But like, I can remember playing for the Lizards and a goalie from Boston was talking trash. And it wasn't Gittleman. It was
Kip Turner.
No, it wasn't Kip. This is when Team USA played because the guys were away at the World Games. I forget his name. But anyways, he was talking trash, and you know it's tough as a goalie because like if we light you up. Like, what do you have to say? Like, you can't, you better be like posting a shutout and like stuffing us all over. But we ended up lighting him up. It's like, huh, it didn't work out for you, man. Like, you should not talk trash.
So do you have to make a play in that game to start talking or you just have to get in like the scoring play and then you get going?
I personally, I remember, I forget his name, but he was like, laughing like you know if some guy shot he was like laughing like you know popcorn whatever and I mean I lit him up I think I want to say I had five on him
yeah
and we won him it's like dude shut up man you should be quiet it's I think it was after like two or three I started you know jawing him back.
Fueled you, right? One of the best goalie chirps I heard was in high school. This guy said, was there a bee's nest in there? Just nodding all my shots. So, no, last question for you, Joe, and we'll let you get back to it. Just, you know, being down there in SoCal now, and I do want you to kind of touch on J-Dub one training and just what you're up to these days, but also just kind of as you touched on before, just like the excitement of around 3 years out, right? LA 28 coming on and just the excitement. How is the excitement manifesting where you are currently and just
So
3 years is a long time, but
we're in the Bay, so we're NorCal. So we were in SoCal first. We're in SoCal first. We moved out to the West Coast. I was working with the league with the PLL Academy, and you know that took us to COVID, and you know made the decision to move up to the Bay. And it's been great. Like we love it up here. It's nice. I'm lucky in that, you know, the reason to move up here was to start a club, and there's a lot of club lacrosse in this area. But you know, I touched on it earlier, you know, box really helped my game. It transformed my game, and I've just seen it. If you look at like Tom Schreiber, you look at some of these guys that play box, it helps your overall game. There's no way around it. I have a problem with people that say it doesn't, or that it creates bad habits, because that's a really short-sighted way of looking at it. It's a different game, and if you're worried about that hurting your field game, you're mistaken, because it just adds another component, another dynamic. So I ultimately ended up starting a box club called Gold Rush, and you know, we started with three teams, and you know, now there's six or seven teams. We go to two tournaments, one in Vegas, one in Utah, same two tournaments every year. And it's just nice to be able to pass on that aspect of my playing career and how it helped me so much onto the next generation. And then recently we started USA West, which is again based out of the Bay Area. But we have kids coming now from all over the country. We go back east, and you know, we have some competitive teams. And again, ultimately, the goal is to help kids get to that next level. You know, it's the pinnacle of the sport. It is to get recruited, you know, to play in college, and we're just trying to help in any way, every way we can. And then with that, I get to work with kids on a day-to-day basis. So I train kids full time every day. I had, I think, five sessions today. I train girls, train boys. I'm lucky that I get to, again, it doesn't feel like work, because I'm just doing something that I love and just passing on passion. And all the knowledge that I've been lucky enough to learn from all my years playing, and all the coaches that have worked with me and coached me over my career, I just get to pass that on. So it doesn't feel like work, but it sure is fun, you know, to be able to, you know, help kids reach their dreams.
Love it, man. Inspiring my generation, sculpting the next generation to come. Really appreciate you joining the show, and can't wait to see you at IL Summer Cup this weekend.
Yeah, USA West 28th. We'll be there. Watch out.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joe, for joining the pod for a first time Hall of Famer guest on the PLL Happy Hour podcast, to our knowledge. We have had co-founder Paul Rabel on the podcast before he was inducted into his Hall of Fame, after being inducted to the USA Lacrosse Hall of Fame, of course, and both great interviews for different reasons. I maybe stumbled a little bit there from some nerves talking to my childhood hero, receiving the jacket, as I'm sure you maybe stumbled over some nerves not giving a jacket but a ring. Rosie, enlighten our listeners who may have missed the last 10% of the latest 5 minutes non-releasable.
Well, sure. First of all, if you missed 5 minutes non-releasable, shame on you. You should all be ashamed of yourselves. Second, I did in fact drop some news that your boy is now engaged.
Let's go!
Woo!
Woo!
Thank you, thank you.
Lucky lady.
Very much so.
Sport Rosie, breaking news, stepping out of dinners. Other couples are confused. He's got to break some news. And this is why we get it done, because of seasons like this, man. Like, for all the discourse around Beyond Meat, around sponsorships, around drones, like, this collection of offensive talent in this league this year is pretty insane, and CJ Kirst is set to make his debut for week 8 in Fairfield, so that just adds more. But like, Obviously, it hasn't been like the cleanest play offensively. Coming out of an All-Star break, really just the Maryland Whip Snakes. We'll get to all the recaps in fuller depth here, but just you know the Whip Snakes have talent. They're now 2-4, but just Teat, Schellenberger, Xander Dixon doing his thing, Costville throwing twisters. You know this Cannon's offense. You know, had Pat Kavanaugh and didn't have enough space for him. That's how loaded they should be. And, you know, they're going through a little bit of a lull right now. The Utah Archers are the most playoff proven. And they have a target on their backs every time they play. And it's shown the first six games of this season. Philadelphia Water Dogs are insane. Connor Kelly is now firing all cylinders. You know, like Michael Sowers is having his MVP caliber breakout season. Maybe not breakout, but MVP caliber. Kieran McArdle, 500th point. Jake Taylor putting it all together. Like, I do want to get to where you think CJ fits in all of that good stuff. But just like the overall collection of offense, you know, there's always been, even from Joe Walters' era, like, he can't play lefty attack because John Gray Jr. is playing there.
Right.
There's always been this just absolute stockpile of offensive arsenal for such a small league. It's been throughout the years. So sometimes you got to tip your hat to the defense. Shout out Denver Outlaws. But it is really hard to stop these offenses. And as a neutral, trying to be objective journalist, covering this league, it is awesome to watch these games when this collection of offensive personnel is coming together.
Yeah, absolutely. I could not agree more. Just the fact that we had this whole first half of the season where we didn't know what was going to happen on any given night. And the teams finished off heading into the break, everybody basically right around one another in the standing. It just keeps things so much more interesting. It just makes the second half, every play matter that much more. You know, nobody heading into the Chicago weekend was out of it, right? You know, if you have some team that just kind of flat out stunk up the place in the first half, maybe they're trying to piece something together. Maybe they're maybe looking a little bit towards the future. Maybe make some trades or something like that to kind of punt for this year and get ready for next, acquire some draft picks or something like that. But none of that was an option, right? Because everybody believed, and understandably so, because of their standings, you know, their marks in the standings, that they did still have a chance to make a run at it. And, you know, once you get in, then, you know, who knows? It's not like you have to be the number one seed. You know, as long as you get into the playoffs, who knows from there? So just, yeah, every game from here on out just gets to be incrementally and exponentially exciting as far as I'm concerned. And just like you mentioned, you know, influx of, you know, new offensive talent. You look at a guy like a Matt Trainer for the Atlas, like is he the guy who's going to help kind of push them over and finally help them get to where they haven't quite gotten over the years? Or, you know, like you mentioned, Kirst joining the Water Dogs finally. We're going to see him. Maybe he helps them get back to where they were, but definitely weren't there last year, which is why they've got him in the lineup anyway. Just old talent, new talent, everybody coming together, and now it's kind of a battle to see who can get it done the rest of the way. Are a team like the Whip Snakes done? It seems way too early to call it. That's the luxury we have with these really close games thus far. Just talking about that one, how much of it do you feel was the effects of the rust, you know, bye week, All-Star break? They hadn't played in about 20-odd days or something like that. And how much of it 100%. Do you think? Yeah, 100%.
I don't even need to hear the second answer or well, the second
answer. How much credit do you want to give the Denver Outlaws?
They deserve a lot of credit. They are going to be the number one team in the power rankings for the second straight week. But listen, you take 3 weeks off. We've seen a full 48 minutes against the Chaos and a brilliant second half comeback against the Atlas. Those are the two heights of this Whips season. There are only two wins, six games played. Listen, if you take 3 weeks off, any team in this league is going to suffer some rust. You take 3 weeks off against the hottest team, that's going to be really difficult. I like that you put in your wrap-up coincidentally that it the last shellacking of this variety from a Jim Stagnita Maryland team was in 2001, also after the All-Star break. So, you know, Whips, maybe those post-All-Star break Zooms aren't cutting it. All right, let's... but to your point, like, every team's got to be all in on this season. I wrote in the power rankings heading into the heading out of the All-Star break into week 7 play. You know, deals got to be made. You got to find a way to improve your team somehow, and putting on the GM hat was kind of hard. You know, CJ Curse is coming back. Do you kind of sprinkle or hold over some offensive talent if you're Bill Tierney over someone else's head and be like, hey, you want him? Give me your young, great defender, and maybe we can strike up a deal. Figuring out, like, stay tuned for next podcast, because I got to figure out why Brendan Nichtern isn't on the Carolina Chaos quarterbacking that offense. Because that would be a joy. You know, you've won two straight. Yes, don't get complacent. All right? Listen, you got Hiltz over there balling out. Ross Scott is great as an invert midfielder. Hat trick in that second half. That around the world was filth. And Brendan Nichtern alongside Jack Snyker would be an army delight. Salute the troops. So stay tuned, because I'm going to ask around more. I should have done more pre-pod prep for you listeners and gotten some answers out of Spencer Ford and Joe Spallina. But alas, we will find these answers out before too long. The big news coming out of the early week that will be surely forgotten and outdated by the time you're listening to this podcast is Jonathan Donville signing with the Denver Outlaws. The Boston Cannons get rid of him. He goes to the Outlaws, who also have Eric Law in a similar role. We'll see if he gets his milestones. He's only a few goals away from Donville. Younger, probably better option at this point in his career. They get rid of Jack Myers to do so. So some interesting transactions are being made, and we've got to keep track of them, because this is the time, Rosie, that it's going to make a difference. You got to make some fringe moves. No one's going to be trading Michael Sowers or JT Giles-Harris or Blaze Reardon at this point in the season. You got to find a way to work around the edges to make your roster more complete, and you sure as heck can't dig yourself into any more holes if you're the Whip Snakes and Archers.
Right, yeah, it's kind of the double-edged sword of the parity and the, you know, closeness in the standings is the feeling that you're always just kind of still in the hunt could make people a little bit shy to pull the trigger on any sort of big deals, right? Like, if you're not winning and you're just flat out embarrassing yourselves and you say, hey, listen, this clearly isn't working, let's have ourselves a fire sale. Let's move some people. But if you're like, if you kind of get pulled in with the nice play every now and then, and you're like, hey, you know, this will work. it's very easy to kind of convince yourself that, you know, one more piece, right? We get one draft pick in here. And we're good with what we have. One more next year, and we're going to win this whole thing. So, I don't know if sometimes it's not so much that you would want to lose, but sometimes it's a little bit more of an illustration of where you are. I think a team that's kind of dealing with that right now would be California, right? Like
four straight is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Putting it lightly.
The way they kicked things off this season was they were an offensive powerhouse, right? Like after the first 2 weeks, it was like, boy, these guys are just steamrolling everybody. You know, 15 goals against the Outlaws. Obviously, the Outlaws look a little bit different now, but still 15 goals then. And then they dropped 16 on Carolina. Again,
yeah, like most shots ever.
Yeah, yeah. That was just like, they seemed like, okay, this is a team that is going to be the sort of run-and-gun offense that just keeps peppering you, and you're just not going to have enough to withstand the entire barrage, right? Past few weeks, it hasn't played out that way. It looks like either teams are adjusting, or maybe they're not adjusting in game. I'm not really sure how you want to slice and dice what's going on with them, but the way I saw it, as far as just goal scoring goes, the first two games, they scored 31 points total. The last three, they scored 31 points total. So, concerns.
So this was by far the best game of the weekend. It had the most playoff implications. And these were two teams, I think everyone projects to be fighting for that last spot in the West. And the Archers are handing California some favors right now by still figuring things out. But listen, like, they were in control in that second half, and it took everything for Carolina to complete that comeback, including not retaliating on that Chris Kavanaugh hack job. Listen, you get two slashes when the whistle goes, and it's really tough not to react. You add in that Graham Hossack slap over the helmet that broke his stick. The Kavanaughs have been getting lit up, all right? Newman lit them up earlier in that game. They have a right to be frustrated, but for Carolina to hold back, and, you know, you can see Rowlett like, all right, you're going to go over to the sin bin. We can't do anything because we got to win this game. We can't be fighting now.
Yep.
Took a lot of discipline and resulted in some inspired play on the offensive end with, you know, Ross Scott balling out. Charlon Beattie's had that nice riser. To be winning two straight without Shane Knobloch in the midfield, Eric Dobson hasn't been working out too well either. He was on the reserve roster this weekend. It's an impressive effort out of Carolina, and to turn this season around after that languid 20-burger given up in Homewood, at Homewood, was pretty remarkable. So, to your point, though, Rosie, what did you make of – did you have any other kind of takeaways from that second half?
Just the three goals total by California, that is something, you know, it's one of those things I wish I had an answer for, right? You know,
Blaze Reardon? Is it simple as that?
No, because it's just something that keeps plaguing them, you know, it's, yep, regardless of who's in front of them. They're just having these dry spells where they're just not producing for significant periods of time. You know, they'll get shut out for a quarter, you know, they'll score two and a half or something like that. Just the tendency of the offense to just entirely stop producing is, even if you have a strong defense, and you know they have a defense that can cause a lot of turnovers. Guys like Arden Cohen can put the ball on the ground a lot, and they have, you know, strong face-off play. So, you know, they're going to get chances. Even if they do give one up, they're going to get a chance to get it back, right? But just the disappearance, you know, something that the Atlas really emphasized earlier this season was full 48, right? Like that was their, I don't know if it's still their slogan, but it definitely was for one of their games. And it's really important for every team in all of these games. if you have these lapses, just with the level of talent that is pretty similar, you know, obviously you have some teams that really look to be putting it all together and firing all cylinders, but kind of fundamentally speaking, there isn't, I would say, a team with just an absolute lapse of talent. Like, there are a lot of superstars, right, very talented people in this league, but if you're not going to deliver, you know, we'll say 45 minutes of the game, someone is going to take advantage of that lapse.
It's been crushing the Archers this season. They've gone at least a quarter or more without scoring. And I don't think it quite got to that level against the Water Dogs this weekend in Chicago. But, you know, I think it did, actually. The two games on Friday night followed very similar paths in terms of the New York Atlas and Philadelphia Water Dogs getting out to early starts. Using a couple pole goals from rookie LSMs, Mike Grace and Ben Weyer, to get some momentum behind them. And, you know, Boston really never came back. They had a couple consolation goals late. Archers, they came back, pulling it back to 12-9. I perked up. I was like, all right, maybe we got a game here. And Philly pulled away. To me, it's going to be tough to find a way to, like you said, you can't go through those lapses, but at the same time, like, to go back to my original point, I have a hard time reconciling the fact that how loaded these offenses are. So, like, no wonder that you can't contain or can't keep up with Jeff Teton, Connor Schellenberger. No wonder you can't keep up with when Connor Kelly is starting to get his, and Michael Sowers is spraying it around, you know? Kieran McCardle's throwing no looks for his 500th career point. Like, these are loaded teams, and, you know, the Archers are starting to get healthy. I did enjoy, this was one of my favorite parts of the weekend, actually. They ran a segment of Tom Schreiber mic'd up, and in it, Schreiber, it's like they're fighting to go out on the same line as Trey LeClair. He's like, all right, Grant, you want him? You want to go out with Trey then? It's like, once Schreiber started going out with them, it's like they started to score some goals, and for the reasons that we stipulated last podcast, with, you know, he's such a good screener, he can can it from deep. But yeah, man. From there, like, what did you make of? Are you more impressed with, you know, the Water Dogs staving off that comeback attempt at 12-9, or Atlas's ability to never let Boston get in that game?
I would say the Atlas ability to never let Boston get into the game. You know, they just kind of sort of established the tempo, established what they wanted to do on offense, and just largely delivered. You know, Connor Schellenberger just kind of looked like he had an extra gear that he could switch into. And, you know, obviously Jeff Teat was just kind of doing Jeff Teat stuff. So, you know, I would think on the, you know, kind of the inverse of that, I was a little bit surprised if, you know, Boston puts up three goals in the first half. And, you know, this is another sort of situation where you look at the roster and it's largely what you remember it being. You know, the names are what they should be. There aren't any glaring omissions. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, it's not like Asher Nolting broke his leg and he's out of the lineup and they're trying to figure it out, right? Like, these are the guys that they want there. These are the guys they believe will take them all the way. And, you know, Cannon's heading into the season, it was effectively, okay, we've seen what this offense can do. If we tighten things up a little bit on defense, you know, championship is within the grasp, right? Like, the defense was the side where they're like, okay, maybe we get a little bit more security there, you know, bring in an Owen Grant. Okay, looking great. But now you're looking at it and you're saying, well, what's exactly happening where we're scoring three goals in the first half of this game? Is there a actual distinction between New York and Boston right now, like as far as, you know, likelihood for success the rest of the way? Or is this just kind of a bad game? It's tough to point the finger when a team has its full lineup that you had previously seen executing so well, you know?
That sequence of Xander Dickson taking that low angle shot, Teat missing that behind the back, and Hugh Kelleher canning the rebound in all about 0.5 seconds was really indicative of just Colin Kearse getting absolutely peppered. Yeah, like, I do want to see Coulter be more aggressive. We know he has it in him. We saw it when he finally switched fields and threw a ridiculous over-the-top skip to Matt Campbell. I was like, oh, that is filthy. Where was that all game, you know?
Right.
By that time, it was too little too late. So your concerns are quite valid. A team who does not have too many concerns about them are the Denver Outlaws. These guys are soaring. Brendan O'Neill was taken the reigning defensive player of the year to the rack. Like, that spin out of the early offense, refusing the screen on the wing and just near side blast was awesome. I did really enjoy his two-pointer where they passed it to Grant Bunny, and it was like a little touch pass up, and he canned it from deep. Bernhardt, PCAV, hat tricks, Wisnowskis playing connector, crease guy. Yeah, and another connector, crease guy in Donville. Rosie, when that offense is clicking and you got a defense that has JT Giles Harrison and undefeated rookie Logan McNady, how do you beat these guys?
Well, you don't. If they're all clicking on all sides, you don't. Like, I think this was a really good illustration of that because, you know, Joe Nardella goes 16 for 22, right? You know, the thinking might be, okay, well, look, if they score once, maybe we can stop them from getting hot because we're going to win the faceoff most of the time. And, you know, maybe we can kind of throw off their rhythm, you know, short shot clock or whatever. But, you know, we're going to get our chances. We'll get the ball back every time. It's not make it take it here. But it didn't matter. You know, if you have a faceoff man who can go 6 for 21 and you're still going to double up your opponent, it's a little bit too much to overcome. I would say,
Before you get to your next point,
yeah,
because the 32-second shot clock is still a very fascinating talking point in this league. You know, whether the went it backwards, forwards, where have you, the analytics are very compelling. We heard Stags talk about it after the Villanova game, like Nardella was winning 65% plus, and they weren't winning. They lost their first three, and he was like, you know what? It's probably not a tenable situation for us to have that many 32-second possessions. So it's really interesting when Nardella is that dominant again and they struggle that much. Like, you got to shake things up and, add some more dynamic players down into attack, which they've done, tried to do. But, just adding more context to your point is, like, it's crazy to even fathom that just being that dominant in the face-off department is not yielding good results. Because, like we see it with the Archers, they do need more possessions, man.
Right. They could perhaps.
They're not as efficient as these Outlaws.
Yeah. I was watching this Outlaws Whipsnakes game, and I was thinking that I was glad that I didn't write a fantasy piece this year. Because last year, because honestly, I would have said, don't pay to get Brendan O'Neill in your lineup for this game. And I would have looked like a jerk So I'm glad I didn't put that down on paper. But last year, he had
You could tell you were just thinking about it.
Right. He was mad in advance. Just a hypothetical situation. And he was like, I'll show that guy for thinking it. Because, last season, two very unremarkable games in the regular season against the Whipsnakes for O'Neill. You know, he had like 1 point in the first one, and I think two in the second game. But, you think about what's the difference, and there's a lot of differences around him now. You got Kavanaugh, got Bernhardt in there. He doesn't have to have that same sort of responsibility that's constantly on his shoulders. He's a lot more free and available to, we saw a great play by him where he just kind of pulled up from around the arc and just tossed a nice little soft feed right to the crease to Bernhardt, because he can still command the attention, but he doesn't have to deliver on it. He can just drop it off to somebody else. Or if you want to, force him to be the guy, careful what you wish for.
That was a great look, because you knew he really wanted to rip it.
Right. He was ready to just let it go. And he was like, oh,
Bernie is just too open not to give it to him.
He was just naked on the crease, so he just tossed it right over to him. The Outlaws, I thought they looked just phenomenal with the ball movement. Transition game has kind of been one of their signatures for, 90% of the season so far, right? And as good as they have been, obviously the Whipsnakes didn't do them favors. They put themselves in positions that, honestly, we haven't seen them put themselves in recently. I don't recall watching a game where so many backdoor cuts stood out to me on the professional level in maybe ever. It's something that you reach that point, it shouldn't be happening, right? But I'm watching this game going, okay, yep, somebody else got beat. And, off-ball play was, I think it was so much kind of, I don't know how much you want to put on the rust factor of it, but like some of these things are just maybe mental lapses that we haven't seen from them or any team with any sort of consistency. And like I was saying, nobody will let you get away with that. There's just too much talent on the opposing side, no matter who you're playing. So, if you're going to ball watch, every team's going to destroy you, especially a team like the Outlaws. If you are going to get a shot clock violation at the top of the 2-point arc, like, first of all, that indicates that nobody had any inclination to pay attention to the shot clock.
Not just once.
Right. They're just.
They did twice in pretty quick succession.
Right. That is an impressive sort of thing. That's like, wow, you guys were not at all watching the clock. And, if you drop it at the arc, and you give it to JT Giles Harris, good luck. You got to chase him down and hope he doesn't make the right pass. And he can make that right pass. So, they certainly didn't do themselves any favors. But I think the Outlaws are just really putting things together right now. Adding Donville to the roster, just picking him up because you got the opportunity is a tremendously fortunate move for them. McNaney has been ridiculous, just elevating the team to a different level. Remarkable. Again, I'm going to put this out here. If this continues on this sort of pace, I don't know how he isn't a prime candidate for both Rookie of the Year and MVP. Because if you lose all your games when he's not in the lineup, and you win all the ones when you are, that seems like the very definition of value to me. So, a lot of games left to be played, but he's looking mighty valuable right now.
These are the analytics you come to the IL Happy Hour podcast for. 4-0 as the starter for the Denver Outlaws now. We touched on it last pod, so I don't want to go too deep into it, but just describing that, the hippo drill, 3 seconds to pass. This is such a star-studded offense that, you're adding another member of that 2022 Maryland offense, which I consider to be the highest level I've ever seen a lacrosse offense play at. in terms of moving the ball to the backside so quickly, so many times. And obviously you get a shorter clock to do it in the PLL, but that the defense can't keep up. And you're going to get great looks out of it each possession. And these Stars are really able to finish those off. So I do want to go more into a bird's eye view. I do want to touch on something that you asked in the post-game pressers after that Carolina game, because I do think it's been showing with these schedules. You know, like the first year, the introducing these home markets and the tour-based model created some random scheduling. You know, you referenced the Outlaws playing the Whipsnakes, Denver versus Maryland twice. Now it's you're playing everyone in your conference twice, and it's resulted in some, fun extracurriculars at times, but more so just really intense games when it's two conference foes playing each other. What have you made of just the overall schedule differences from year to year?
Yeah, so I think lacrosse fans, or PLL fans at least, really love skepticism, right? Like, if something's presented to them and you say, we're going to change things up and it's hopefully going to create this atmosphere, right? Or it's going to change the vibe a little bit. There is a big sort of inclination to say, I doubt that's going to happen, or I think that's false, or you're just saying that to make me think this way. I'll give you an example. You say, okay, New York versus Boston. Got ourselves a rivalry here. And then you'll hear people say, it's not really. They're just saying that because it's New York and Boston, right? But then you talk to a player, like when we talked to Ash Nolting, he's like, oh, no, that's true. We do not like them, and they do not like us. That is a rivalry. Say, okay, it turns out, is it created? Sure. Is it an organic evolution where they actually do not like each other? Yes, it is true. Both things can be true. And I think what we've seen when you create these conferences is you say, okay, now we got conferences, now we got conference rivals, now we got heat. And the initial sort of reaction can be, okay, look, it's the same teams. Just because you put them in this group over that group, it doesn't mean they're going to dislike each other. But I think it actually, partially organically, partially because of the way that it's set up, it is generating this sort of tension. Physicality gets ramped up. The teams understand that they're fighting for limited resources. And obviously every game is important, but if you're going against a team in your conference, you need to absolutely make sure that, whatever you can do, scratch and claw to make sure you're keeping them down, because their failure makes you so much happier than an Eastern Conference opponent losing a game if you're a Western Conference team. And so, yeah, I was asking after the Carolina-California game, because I'm watching the game and I'm like, this seems a little personal, right? Like, it's obviously a game here, but it seems like these guys just kind of seem sick of each other's crap. You know, like, how did we get to this point? And, the people who answered up, Troy Ray and Roy Colsey, were like, yeah, listen, we're going to see these same guys again. We are fighting for the same thing. And it's not just, fighting for the championship or something like that. It's like, we can't be last in this conference, or our season is over. So we have to beat these guys. And, you don't know what's going to happen with these records. So you got to stomp them out. If you're up by 8 and there's 10 seconds left, go score another goal. They're going to be very mad about it, but you need that score differential. So whatever it's going to take, maybe you're going to have to hit them a little bit harder than you'd hit anybody else. And I think we saw that this past weekend, the way that Chaos and Redwoods kind of went down. You mentioned the slashes there with Kavanaugh and Verge. I think Kavanaugh also just sick of everybody's crap, constantly trying to hurt him. That's product of his play. And that's just a thing I think he's going to do throughout his career. But yeah, Roy Colsey said it best. He's like, Familiarity breeds contempt. And we're going to see these guys twice. And, you know, you see somebody once, you see them, and then maybe you see them next year or whatever, whatever. If you see a team once and they're scrapping to get whatever they can out of the game, and then you're going to see them 4 weeks later or something like that, you're going to remember the cheap shots. You're going to remember everything they did to put you down. And then you get your shot at retaliation right away. It is a breeding ground for the hostility and tension to ramp up. So, yeah, I think we're seeing it, and I think we're going to continue to see it throughout the season.
Familiarity breeds contempt. You know, Rosie, we're becoming more familiar with each other every podcast. I have zero contempt for you, all right? Just wanted the listeners to know that. You did almost escape me asking you about this very important personnel lineup question with CJ Kirst returning to the lineup. Two straight wins for Philly. You got lefties Kieran McArdle, Thomas McConvey balling out. Jake Taylor is tying it all together in that attack trio. How do you insert the reigning Tourton winner, one of the greatest college seasons of all time, into this lineup?
My theory, based on absolutely nothing, is they say, hey, kid, you're young, you got fresh legs, you're in shape, you haven't been, you know, getting drilled with lacrosse balls and nobody's been cracking a stick across your head. You're ready to go. Just play some midfield for a little while. We can set you up anywhere. You know, what even is midfield most of the time in the PLL, right? Like, are you above the arc? Are you dropping on the crease? Are you going to take some inverse runs? It's kind of largely a name only. You know, it's not so much like it was, you know, when the league started or a lot of like high schools or something like that. You're not doing the whole staying on the field and running 99% of the game. Some players do. You know, some players do kind of have that niche to them, but if you're not looking for someone to do that, I think they're just going to roll him out the box, have him set up how he would regularly set up. Still expect to see Sowers dealing from X or behind GLE for a lot of his, you know, sort of wing dodging and things like that. And I just think they're going to roll him out in the midfield and not really shake up their core with the attack. I could be 1,000% wrong, but that's my expectation. What do you...
It's your expectation. I think you're spot on. I think it's the way to go. And I think it's a good way to bookend this podcast, mostly because Joe Walters came into this league with John Grant Jr. Now, I think it's more of a reverse in this situation. To his point, Kieran McArdle's criminally underrated throughout his career. I think his... I loved that his answer that he played like him, because that was also a nail on the head. Anyway, back to this point, though, it's more like Kirst is the junior in this situation, and McArdle is, to Walter's point, the Joe Walters. So, listen, like, CJ Kirst against a short stick is a scary thought. If he scores three straight, do you, as Dylan Sheridan, want to keep him on the field? Or do you want to work for him to get to the best matchups and have the best production? And have the best overall cohesion in six-man offense that, as stated earlier, does need six players playing together like the Outlaws are doing.
I think the way they're going to see it is, you know, he's been out this entire time, and they've had so many games to see what works. And we've seen the Water Dogs offense delivering at such a high level. I think their main objective here has to be just, you know, hey, hop in and contribute where you can. We don't need you to do anything. You know, like, they're not flailing around offensively just like, you know, oh man, when's CJ Kirst going to get here to help us out? You know, it'll be a great addition, but they don't really need to change everything to make sure he's going to help carry them. You know, he can be the fourth best player in their offense this weekend, and that'll be just fine. You know, he can get three shots if he can get three shots. And, you know, obviously if he has a great game, if he goes off and if he scores 6-2 and, you know, they win by 24 goals, then good for him and good for everybody. But I think they're so comfortable with the way things are going now. It's really just a matter of him being able to get some runs and get familiar and, you know, just make sure his legs are there and, you know, stuff like that more than them particularly needing him to help the team.
No, absolutely. And the funny thing about this injury, talking to college coaches the tail end of May, you know, like, he wasn't dodging as much. He turned into the best cutter in the nation. He turned into the best off-ball player. Coaches were like, does he have a lower body injury? What's going on with this guy? You heard hip, you heard ankle, you heard all sorts of things during championship weekend. Turns out to be the wrist, all bandaged up for a sling, in a sling for a few weeks. And pretty good recovery time, I will say. We thought we might see him last week. Again, didn't need him. Got the dub. And yeah, it'll be exciting to see how Philly employs him in his pro debut. Rosie, let's wrap this podcast off with a super bird's eye look at things, maybe even the next 5 years. A couple podcasts ago is when the news broke, right after we released, that ESPN was signing a new 5-year deal with a minority equity stake in the league, kind of a new unprecedented, semi-precedented move from the broadcast partner of the league. Now, I think we can gesticulate, guess that the league is making some concessions to maybe get in that airtime, get some more SportsCenter coverage. And it's been working, you know. You get more eyeballs in the sport that way. You're getting that placement on ESPN Plus to be that front foremost first tile of, you know, also live or even in that first spot. Rosie, you know, both of us were at the PLO end of season awards dinner ceremony last year in Washington, D.C., where Paul Rabil, Mike Rabil, the co-founders of this league, spoke pretty in depth about their future plans for the league, their hopes to re-sign with ESPN. That has come to fruition. What are your kind of overall takeaways of what we can see from here?
Well, so I think just, you know, teaming up with ESPN, and I think this kind of is perhaps as most as formal a team up as could possibly be, right? You know, now that you know that not only are they broadcasting, but they do have some skin in the game, is just incredibly important to the PLL. Because if you think about it, like, what happens to this league if they lose all the momentum that ESPN is responsible for providing them? You know, I don't know if there's anything in the world that is by any means comparable to getting on a sports center or, you know, having these players interviewed before the games, or ESPN's doing their, you know, 50 states in 50 days or whatever it was that they were doing. And it's like, hey, we're going to stop off at the PLL All-Star game. It is just kind of a boost of legitimacy that ESPN understands they provide. And I think it's kind of perfect for them to have a little bit of financial incentive. So you kind of know, listen, they're probably not going to push the PLL to the back burner, right? Because if they bury it, that's going to hurt their pockets. They want to make the league as profitable as it can be, because obviously they get more cash out of that. So, you know, I don't know the numbers. They don't broadcast the kind of figures exactly, but it certainly seems like ESPN has an understanding that not only do they want to promote this product, they want to push it even further than it's been before. So it's going to be exciting to see what that means for the game. So far, it means pretty cool things as far as ads go. You see more players on, you know, countdowns like SportsCenter, see more interviews. People always talk about wanting to get more more player faces out there, more player personalities out there. And, you know, ESPN does seem interested in doing that. We've seen a lot of interviews this past year compared to, say, years previously, seeing the Kavanaughs or Baptiste or Miles Jones or guys like that. So as far as what the future holds, I think it's kind of interesting trade-off, right? Like, they're obviously going to want to make their product bigger. And, you know, you mentioned the kind of industry, state of the industry sort of speech address we kind of heard previously, you know, Paul Rabel, Mike Rabel talking about where things go from here. Obviously, the business getting bigger means more teams. And, you know, if you have more teams, you're going to need to expand your schedule. Can't have, you know, 14 teams playing.
Before you even get to more teams.
What's that?
Before you even get to more teams.
Yeah.
You got to expand the schedule to get players more full-time wages and et cetera, right? Then you can, once you see more profit flowing, the more games you play, the more money, more revenue you're going to drive in. So the front office of this league is, they're going to want more games with not as few players, but they don't want to dilute it so much that they have to spread that revenue even more. So, yeah, quickly jump it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it is it's a pain, right? If you're going to have to keep, say, what, like 50 more people in every hotel you go to or all that stuff, it all just kind of becomes an increasing logistical nightmare. So, yeah, you want more games. And then, of course, the question becomes, where are those games going to go chronologically? And that is kind of it's funny, it's kind of a difficult question that everybody is aware of when you start talking about the PLL and its relationship with other sports. And because the league has this little sort of niche on the calendar right now that I think works out well as far as my personal schedule goes, right? You know, things start up right when the college season is dying down. And then, you know, it's going to end right around September. And it seems to work out pretty well. But if you want to be more successful and you want to spread out and you get bigger and bigger, you got to go somewhere else. So you got to either start earlier or finish later. And that is a very tricky, tricky prospect. And I think that's something they're dealing with right now, right? Like, they have emphasized they have a good, strong relationship with the NLL. And, you know, the Rabels and Fruit and all those people, they know one another. And contrary to what, you know, some person on a message board might tell you, they do acknowledge one another's existence. And they do understand that everybody's trying to promote the game and make some cash as well. So where does it go? If it goes a little bit earlier, you're going to have a sort of a conflict with the indoor season. And then ultimately, what they've kind of acknowledged is, look, if we're going to keep getting bigger and everybody's going to keep getting bigger, the same players aren't going to probably be able to keep doing both things. And people are probably going to have to choose.
Mike Rabel said as much.
Yeah. It's just kind of one of the truths of expanding these businesses, right? So that's kind of one of the key factors, I think, moving forward. Is what are we going to see as far as guys choosing one or the other, you know? So like that's kind of what jumps out to me as one of the signs of growth that's going to be a little bit of a bump in this road.
They don't want to go up against the NFL. This will be the first year that we won't be hearing as many heartbroken fans not making the championship game. So as Joe Walter said, get your butts in seats in Philadelphia, Harrison, New Jersey, and of course the first round in Minneapolis. So otherwise, you hit it all. Very well said. It'll be interesting to see the split of players, the workload with college season and pro coinciding. maybe we get some midweek games going in the future. This is all very future stuff, listeners. All right. If you've made it this far in the podcast, do not panic. All these details will be ironed out, and we appreciate you joining on for another PLL Happy Hour podcast. And you know what to do next. Share with a friend. Tell us what you think. Leave a review, and catch us back here on InsideTheCross.com and wherever you get your podcast here next week.